It's really lovely to be here this evening, and particularly to be thinking through this question, how can we know if God is there? You remember last week, I suppose, if you were here, we were looking at questions like, how can we know God, and how can we know anything? And so I'm going to try quite hard not to duplicate some of that territory. I think this question, how can we know if God is there, is an existential question. That is to say, it's the kind of question that deals with our felt experience in life. It's the kind of question, actually, that's to do with the distance that many people feel when they think about God, such that you have many Christians who perhaps go for many years in their faith and then find themselves wondering why God feels so far from them. This question, it seems to me, is less about whether we could have good philosophical and historical proof towards God's existence. More of a cry, is he there? Is he for me? Can I know that he's there? Can I know that he's for me? Certainly for many people who aren't Christians, that would be part of their question about whether God was there in the first place. There are so many little hints and signs that there must be something more to life. And yet nothing obvious, is there? There was a Mitchell & Webb sketch, it was quite good satire, in which someone cuts open a watermelon and the seeds inside were arranged to spell the words, "There is no God." And all the other scientists were sort of, you know, proclaiming this was a wonderful, miraculous event that finally gave a big... That was a funny moment, but the fact is, moments like that just don't happen. Most people go through life without actually feeling the closeness of God, and they want to know why. As I say, this is an existential question. It's a really big question. And because it's an existential question, I want to base most of what I'm saying this evening from the Bible, obviously, but also the stage show and novel and phenomenon, Les Miserables. I got to see it last Saturday, and it was absolutely fantastic, as it always was. Tears and screams, and that was just me watching it. And I think it's one of the most excellent presentations of the human condition. Victor Hugo, without himself being a believing Christian, actually giving for us, I think, various different responses to these questions, and various different examples of characters who either do or do not find closeness with God. So, I think the whole musical, you could say, is to do with this question of, is God there? And how do I know? The whole thing begins, if you've seen the musical, with a chain gang singing, and one of the people pipes up, "I've done no wrong, sweet Jesus, hear my prayer." To which the rest of the chorus reply, "Look down, look down. Sweet Jesus doesn't care." Fantine, as she's about to have her baby taken away and put in prison forever, cries out, "Holy God, is there no mercy? If I go to jail, she'll die." Right at the start of this play, musical, the film adaptations and the book, is a question, what about humanity in its lowest ebb? Down at those extremes, crying out for God, finding nothing. Is there a God? Can we know? Well, as I say, I've got three characters who I think actually provide three different approaches that people have towards God. One of them works and two of them don't. Just to give you the kind of headlines now, Thénardier's approach, he's the sort of scumbag innkeeper, is to happily deny any God at all, and therefore any authority over his life, and to make everything about him and his own personal wealth. Javert is a character that I think it's easy to sympathize with. He's a policeman. He has a complex past. He was born in a prison himself and has kind of pulled himself up by his bootstraps into a strict, law-abiding police officer. And I think what he's going to show us is the perils of wanting God on your own terms. But the third character, in fact, the main character of the whole thing, is the convict, Jean Valjean, whose discovery of God is exactly that, a discovery. And the whole plot of the book, the play, all of it, is set in motion by his amazing discovery of a God who intervenes. Of these three, one of them realizes a God who is there. So that's basic headlines for where we're going. We have a whole hour together this evening, and I have an awful lot that I will say if you don't stop me. So do jump in at various points. If you have questions, I may defer your question to a later point. We may pause and take a look at it. But without further ado, those are the three sort of people I want to think through. So firstly, Thénardier. There's a horrific moment once the barricades come down and all the corpses line the sewers, in which Thénardier sings about the world. It's a world where the dogs eat the dogs, where they kill for the bones in the street. And God in his heaven, he doesn't say a word, because he's dead as the stiffs at my feet. Not long ago, in the last century, there were people who were very much happy to take that God is dead banner. In fact, a century before, it was Nietzsche who'd given us that exact formulation. But Thénardier is an example of what happens when people live like that seriously. He goes through the sewers, rifling through people's possessions, taking gold teeth out of people's mouths and rings off their fingers. And he doesn't care that what he's doing might be wrong. As far as he's concerned, the God that other people think is out there is dead. And Thénardier is a very ugly example of something the Bible is very quick to talk about. You may know it from Psalm 14, for instance. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And in this context, the Hebrew word for fool is not so much someone lacking in the intellectual department. It's someone whose way of life is crooked, is wicked. Thénardier is an example of someone who has no experience of God's presence because he doesn't want to have an experience of God's presence. He doesn't want there to be a God at all. And I suppose that's one of the questions. Why does God feel distant? And one of the answers the Bible gives, perhaps a shocking answer, is this. It's because he is distant. Something's gone wrong. We weren't made for this tremendous distance, this chasm between us and God. But nonetheless, there it is. If you know the very opening sequences of the Bible, particularly Genesis 3, we see just that. Have I put it up? I have. We have a moment in which the man and the woman that God created live in this garden, secure, peaceful, prosperous, enjoying, best of all, close fellowship with him. You can see there the first verse in verse 8. They heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And just those words give us a little insight into what human beings were made for. The kind of relationship in which God walked with us in the cool of the day, in which no one would ever have to say, is God there? Is he for me? Because he was. And everything they experienced showed them, underlined it. But as I say, something went wrong. And this moment highlights what's happened after what Christians call the fall. The moment in which, given the choice between living in line with God's will and not, human beings opted to kick him out of the picture. God comes walking in the cool of the day, and Adam and Eve are nowhere to be found. And God says, where are you? He's not asking that because he doesn't know or because he's a bit short-sighted. He's asking that because something fundamental has gone wrong in the relationships between God and human beings. From this point on, God's distanced from us by our own rejection of him. And so for anything to happen between him and us, there is a chasm that has to be crossed. He has to come looking, saying, where are you? And even when he does, it isn't exactly promising. Adam and Eve are hiding. We heard you in the garden, and we were naked, so we hid. And God says, who told you you were naked? And again, it's not that he doesn't know. It's not that he doesn't know what the serpent has done. But he's saying to Adam and Eve, you didn't get this feeling of alienation from yourselves, from one another. You didn't get that from me. That came from something else. That came from walking away from me. What we were made for is a close walk with God. The fact we don't have one tells us that there's a huge distance. And what the Bible says, hard as it is to hear, is that that distance is because the relationship has been wrecked. And our day-to-day decisions not to live God's way have worked themselves out in that way. I was surprised when I read the 20th century and I think quite theologically liberal Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay, say this in his letter to some trainee priests. He says, when people complain that God seems to be distant, God seems to be absent, he gives them this advice. Recall a biblical doctrine too often forgotten, the doctrine of divine judgment. When men and nations turn away from God's laws and prefer the courses dictated by pride and selfishness to the courses dictated by conscience, calamitous results follow. God is not absent from the contemporary scene. He is present. present in judgment through the catastrophes which follow human willfulness. Now, I'm sorry to begin with such a downer, but the fact is, that is where the Bible begins. If you have ever asked the question, where is God and why doesn't he feel near? The answer Scripture gives you is that the world we live in is not the way it was made to be. Something has gone terribly wrong. And that feeling of closeness for which we were made, which is why this question is even a question, that won't come back to us unless something is done about it. However, and here's the thing, it wasn't just the man and the woman in the garden rejecting God that led to this problem. As Michael Ramsey alludes to, it's also our day-to-day behavior. The ways in which all of us reject God continue to put up the barrier. So in his letter to the Romans, Paul writes in chapter 1, like a repeating drumbeat through his account of human sin, that God gave them up to what they'd chosen. Why is it that we feel so distant from God? In a way that is fair, but very sad, God is giving us what we want. That's what Romans 1 is underlining. And that's why a Thénardier can flourish in on the stage, but also in life, because there are so many characters like that. The 20th century tells us about some of them, great tyrants who publicly deny God and do what they like. This condition that the Bible calls sin, this rejection of God, that's fundamentally the reason why people made in his image feel estranged from themselves and don't know the closeness they were made to have. And in fact, were you to stay in Romans chapter 1, Paul says that actually we're without excuse. Every one of us has enough to go on to know that there is something more out there, a God who made everything. And I think if you were to go onto the website, you'd be able to listen to the talks from last week or other Reasonable Faith talks. There are plenty of things we could talk about, from looking at the natural world to assessing the historical evidence of the Christian faith. There's so much to go on, and yet the Bible tells us that we are predisposed not to believe because at some level we don't want to. I'm saying some really very hard things here. So do come back to me if you feel they're unwarranted. So just a quick moment. Let's think about Pascal's wager. You'll find it in his Pensée. And I think, I could be very wrong on this, and wiser heads can correct me, but I think Pascal's wager is generally misunderstood. You know the terms of the wager. Pascal says, given that if there is a God, your rejecting him would cost you everything. And if there weren't a God, your accepting him would actually cost you nothing. Wouldn't it be more reasonable to choose God? Now, I think it's misunderstood because at this point, a lot of people say, what a terrible argument. You can't expect me to play probabilities. That's not really giving me anything to work on. But I don't think Pascal is trying to prove God's existence with this wager. I think what he's trying to do is unmask our attitude that says, there isn't enough to go on. I'm a rational rejecter of the God who is there. Pascal writes this. He sounds like quite a feisty fellow in this particular Pensée. He says, at least get it into your head that if you are unable to believe, it's because of your passions, since reason impels you to believe, and yet you cannot do so. Pascal is writing to educated gambling people who would never have gone to the gambling table and played the odds that they play with their souls. And so what he's saying to them in this wager is, at least recognize, you are not rational in this. Something about you is predisposed to say no to the God who is there. And I want to submit that Genesis, with its account of our alienation from God, is the best explanation of that instinct. We have the philosopher Thomas Nagel, or Nagel, I don't know how you pronounce it. Is it Nagel? Oh, great, because I've never eaten a bagel, but I have eaten a bagel, which is why I thought that. But he says this, and you probably know this, this is from him writing in The Last Word. I want atheism to be true, and I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. My guess is that this cosmic authority problem is not a rare condition. In taking us to Thénardier, I have chosen perhaps the ugliest example possible. And there are plenty of well-meaning people who are not rifling through corpses for gold teeth. And yet I want to say that the attitude Thénardier presents, one which would reject God, coming out of this deep desire for him not even to be there, that attitude of sin is the main reason why God is seemingly absent from our world. In judgment, he gives us the thing we're asking for. I just want to go on a little tangent at this point. I think we have to recognize as well that just as Thénardier acts in the book and in the musical, people who make this kind of claim that there is no God, doing it because they don't want to bow the knee, often end up imposing themselves as the powerful ones. W.H. Auden has been someone I've been really interested in recently. And one of the things that's fascinating about him is that he had a young phase of rejecting the Christian faith. He was sort of briefly caught by communism. But the thing that brought him back was his horror at the rise of Nazi Germany. There you have in his poem Christmas 1940 a little of one of the verses. He says, "Either we serve the unconditional, that is to say God, or some Hitlerian monster will supply an iron convention to do evil by." He later wrote, "The novelty and shock of the Nazis was that they made no pretense of believing in justice and liberty for all, and attacked Christianity on the grounds that to love one's neighbour as oneself was a command fit only for effeminate weaklings." And then he continued, "If, as I'm convinced, the Nazis are wrong and we are right, what is it that validates our values and invalidates theirs?" That question is what led W.H. Auden back to the church in which he'd grown up, back to convictions about God, because he was horrified by what he saw. You can read a biography of him, a really interesting one, written by Humphrey Carpenter, who records a moment in which Auden went to the cinema and he saw American Germans who were watching a newsreel of some of the attacks in Poland. And he was horrified as he saw them scream out, "Kill the Poles, kill them." And he wanted to know what on earth was wrong with human beings that we would do that. And how on earth he could say to them, "No, don't say that." I want us to see that, like Thénardier, the people who dismiss God are often the quickest to set themselves up in his place. If he's not there, then who are we accountable to? That is one of the perverse attractions of dismissing God. Maybe I'm accountable to no one but myself. But where that leads is a truly dark place. Now, I don't want to think that absolutely everyone is in the Thénardier category. But that problem of sin works itself out in another way as well, taking us to our second character, Javert. Why is it that so many people feel distant from God when they really want him to be there, when they are desperate for an experience of him? Just this morning, I had two conversations with people who told me how bitterly disappointed they are by how distant God feels from them. Why is that the case? Well, I think Javert is a good example of this. He's not someone who is rejecting God. In fact, he seems to be a highly religious man. In the book, the reason why Valjean escapes him is because Javert would never suspect the nuns who are hiding Valjean. In his mind, religion is a wonderful thing. Religious people would never do anything wrong. The world is black and white. But I wonder if you notice, if you know the musical, that the kind of God Javert worships is basically a blown-up version of Javert. That's what he's chosen. So when he's callously throwing Fantine into prison, he lectures her, "Honest work, just reward, that's the way to please the Lord." Or as he sings in despair, he says, "I am the law, and the law is not mocked." This is the man who does want to worship God, but the God he's choosing is a God who is entirely on his own terms. And the biblical word for a God on your terms is an idol. That word does not necessarily refer to the sort of little statue or figurine that you might be making. It refers to the human endeavor to paint God in our own image, to shape him the way we want him. Now, what is the problem with demanding God on our own terms? The problems are twofold. I'll come back to this later, but that's a terrible way to treat a person, isn't it? Would you ever enter a relationship like that, demanding that the other person treat you only in the way you wanted to be treated. But secondly, the God you're left with is necessarily smaller than the God who is there, and necessarily more like you than the God who is there. You end up in a bind where the God you've turned to is too small to help you, and too much like you to suggest anything when you're desperately in need of guidance or advice. And, I don't know if you noticed, this doesn't deal with our underlying problem. If our underlying problem is an attitude towards God that puts him out of the picture, this is just a religious version of doing that. We've still not had the real God on his terms. And even though this looks like a pious move, it really is another distancing mechanism to keep God at arm's length, not the parts of him we don't want to have. Also, I think it means that the God that you end up thinking about, even if you're an atheist who's never believed in him personally, ends up being a projection of many cultural fears and values. I remember speaking to a student this week who told me, even if God were there, he wouldn't believe in him, because he couldn't bow the knee to someone who had this crazy desire to be worshipped all the time and was an authority over his life. It's a little bit like sushi, that the idea of which is incredibly unappealing until you actually eat it and discover that it's delicious. For so many people, we're rejecting God because actually the God we've painted is the one we've drawn up out of, I don't know, a great cultural deposit of ideas, or even, I guess, some Freudian things we've picked up from our fathers. God on our own terms can't help us. Now, that's something that Christians are in danger of doing. I don't know if you read through the Old Testament, but again and again, you see that God's people who've had a clear experience of him almost immediately end up passing that experience through their own desires and making this God what they want him to be. No sooner has Moses gone up the mountain than they're down there trying to make a golden calf. So I wonder if anyone here is a believer, we must never think that we are immune from this Javert tendency. And I would say actually that all of the religions in the world, for all of the great good that they often do and all the insight that they often show, are fundamentally weakened by this fact. That because God is not here for us to know, because of the distance between him and us, any way we try to paint him, it's going to become an unflattering self-portrait. It's going to become the God we wish he were. We're going to be limited. But this isn't just a problem for Christians. I think this is also a problem for seekers. I think that for many of the people I've spoken to, and I've asked, well, what is it that would actually convince you to believe in God? I think I've often hit the nail on the head with that question, because they come back with wonderful things. They tell me he would have to do this, he'd have to show that. And undergirding that is an adage that, I don't know who came up with it, but the idea that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Now, to a point, I actually agree with that. And the reason why I changed my mind from being an atheist to being a Christian is because of the extraordinary evidence that Jesus gives to back up his extraordinary claims. But I want us to see that this tendency to render God in our own image is so profound that actually, even as seekers, we might use that idea as a bit of a mask. We might say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, but when we're the ones holding the reins, when we're the ones deciding what extraordinary means, it's possible that no amount of evidence will ever be enough, and that the goalposts would continually shift. I've had that experience. People who tell me we can't know anything about Jesus, he was a mythical figure. You show them the stacks of evidence of his presence in the first century, manifestly not mythical. And then the objection is something else, and then the objection is something else. Now, there's a world of difference between him being an honest seeker who keeps finding more questions, which I think is perfectly normal. There's a world of difference between that and desiring to have God on your own terms and saying, God, if you're out there, meet my expectations. Match everything I'm looking for. Be exactly as I want you to be. Can we hear the danger of even thinking like that? You see, people believing in God's existence is not like you've heard about Bertrand Russell's flying teapot, a small teapot orbiting the earth, no one can see it. We're not talking about something like that. We're talking about someone who is personal. And so it's not like, I don't know, seeing a Yeti or not. Some people think they have, some people think they haven't. This is about a person, and not just any person, but the person who made everything, whose dignity, whose majesty is absolute, who does not owe us his presence, or in fact, any good thing. Again, that's hard to hear, but it means that in our seeking and in our striving to relate to him, we cannot just have him on our own terms. And particularly if you're here as a seeker, we just can't keep shifting the goalposts. That way madness lies. I've got another tangent. One of the complaints I often get from people is that the evidence I'm giving is usually testimony, i.e. what other people have seen in history. And so many of them think, well, that's not good enough to believe. I need to see it for myself. I want to know if people can really stand by that. I'm not very convinced that that objection's cogent. So, time for a quick tangent. There was a documentary that Louis Theroux did with Jimmy Savile. Maybe you remember it. And recently, and I think this was a very humble move, Louis Theroux did another documentary where he revisited many of the people in the first documentary and he talked to some of the victims of Jimmy Savile's sex abuse. And what was remarkable is he had an encounter with a lady called Sylvia Nichols. Did any of you see this documentary? She had a great portrait painted of Jimmy Savile. She even had a Legoland statue of Jimmy Savile's head. And she was a convinced believer in the goodness and uprightness of Jimmy Savile. And she said this: I only saw the good in Jimmy Savile. I never saw anything in that line, that is to say that the abuse claims. And had I seen anything, I would have been the first to report it. When you get older, your memories do become more important. He was a friend to something I spent 50 years of my life with. We wouldn't have a spinal center there now if it wasn't for Jimmy. So I tried to only know, and I do know, that I only saw good. And that's all I can ever say about this. What do you think about that? How does that make you feel? Actually, I feel like I've talked on for quite a while, and we do have a bit of time. So why don't you discuss that in your tables? How does that make you feel? Do you agree with her? If you were talking to her, would you say, no, you're completely right, Sylvia. That's all anyone can say. What do people think? How did that make you feel? What were your responses to her assertions there? What do people think?
I think it makes you uncomfortable. I mean, because you could sort of say, well, maybe he only presented those good sides of himself to her. You know, it's all she saw, and her, what she's saying is fair enough. She does tap in that. She does. There's almost a factual claim there that he presumably, you know, he helped in the spinal center, which you can't really say is not a good thing. So then you presented with the idea that there is some good in someone that we want to deal with this.
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the painful things about this documentary. It shows that this was a man who was conspicuous as a do-gooder. And even though his evil was present and he hid in plain sight, he did many good things. She goes on for some minutes about how many people are alive today who would not have been alive if Jimmy Savile hadn't given that money and built those hospitals. And I also think it's interesting that you raise how difficult it is to find people who aren't just two-dimensional. Thénardier, for instance, is a two-dimensional character. That's why he's so shallow. Javert is a very deep character, and we're pulled in all sorts of ways because we see good and bad mixed in. You know, I see that. Thanks, John. Any other thoughts? How did that make you feel? What did you think about her assertions? Do you think if you were a lawyer prosecuting a case, do you think at this point you'd say, well, fair enough, who can argue with that? Do you see? She says at the bottom there, and that's all I can ever say about this. At which point you say, no, wrong. That may be all you want to say about this, but that's not all you can say about this. That might be all you can say you saw of him, but you can say more because plenty of people come forward with an experience of Jimmy Savile's abuse. Plenty of people have come forward to say what they have been through. And it is actually immoral to put all of that testimony together and say, well, I never saw it, therefore, that's all I can say. I don't think anyone would be happy with that. Our legal system just wouldn't work if we acted in that way. This is a bit of a tangent, but the point I'm trying to make is that it's very dangerous when you try to fashion God in your own image. And this lady, Sylvia Nichols, I think she's caught in the fact that she has too much at stake to get rid of the Savile mythos. And the reason is she has painted him to be a certain thing. And now if you watch that documentary, it's incredibly hard not to feel great pity for her, because her idol has let her down. She even says that she prays about this. She talks to the Lego head of Jimmy Savile and says, I ask him to do something because it felt like he could do anything. But he can't. Javert is in a similar position, although slightly different. Javert, too, is enslaved by the God he's trying to make in his own image, on his own terms. And the problem with a God on our own terms is that we will be disappointed. We will be disappointed. In his absence, we will be disappointed because a God on our own terms, as I said earlier, won't be big enough to help us. But when we ever do encounter the real God, if we only believe in a God on our terms, we'll be disappointed because he'll probably be nothing like what we imagined. His ways will be mysterious to us and we won't be able to function in his world. Spoiler alert, but at the end of Les Miserables, Javert cannot cope with a world that has mercy in it. It does not square with his belief in God, a God who is nothing more than justice. Do this and live, fail and die. And when he sees mercy, he can't cope. He has to end his own life because he cannot live in that kind of world. Now, again, this is a novel. I'm not saying that the consequence of this is going to be suicide, but I am saying that when you actually do encounter the real God, if what you've been working with is God on your own terms, you may not be able to see him as he is. That will cloud you. That will keep you back. And as I say there, finally, this is a distancing mechanism. It is still another way of rejecting the God who is there. It doesn't look like one at first, and perhaps it's not as blatant, but this is a strategy of trying to make God more like we are, more and more. Which, if there is a God who transcends what we are, is really quite a foolish thing to do. And as I said earlier, none of us would have relationships with people in this way, working solely on our own terms. The very nature of a relationship is to be open to the difference in the other person, which is what makes them enjoyable, doesn't it? Wouldn't life be awful if everyone was just like you all the time? Don't you crave variety? I know I do. So how do we get to know God? You have the scumbag Thénardier, who gets a lot of money, gets a lot of influence, but he doesn't get God. You have Javert, he's hardworking, he's moral, but he doesn't get God. Is there any hope? The answer is surprisingly beautiful, or beautifully surprising, because there is hope, and the character who shows us that hope is a convict. A convict actually in the middle of another crime. It's the convict Valjean. What Valjean's arc throughout this novel shows us is that the experience of a God who is there does not feel merely intellectual, does not even feel like wish thinking. It feels like an intervention. A decisive breaking into his life from a presence that no one could have imagined, least of all, Javert. How do we know if God is even there? As I said earlier, our attitude of rejecting him has completely botched the relationship that we could have had. And in the absence of a real relationship with a God who walks with us in the cool of the day, the gods we make up as substitutes aren't good enough. What we need is what Valjean discovers, an intervention. A moment that breaks in, that the God whom we fled from actually wants to know us. And that's what we find in history, that intervention, when we look at God revealing himself on his own terms. That's what we're looking for. You might know the moment, but I'll just say it anyway. Valjean has escaped on parole, and he's found a miserable experience. No one will pay him fairly, no one will take him in. And out of nowhere, the Bishop Myriel does take him in, feeds him, puts him in a bed, and lets him sleep for the night. And Valjean, broken and scarred by a hard world, knows exactly what to do. He gets up, he takes the precious silver candlesticks, and he runs away. And then he's apprehended. And in this act of theft, he's brought back to the bishop's residence, where all of the police are crowing over finding this criminal. And Valjean's paper-thin story that he'd actually been given these silver bits of cutlery, sorry, it wasn't the candlesticks, we'll come back to that in a bit, is looking very thin. And the bishop, out of nowhere, says, "No, I did give him that silver," and then takes the candlesticks and gives it to him, and says, "My friend, you forgot the best bits. Don't leave without these." It's an amazing moment, completely counter to anything Valjean had discovered. It is a moment that Christians recognize very well as grace. The offending party, who deserves nothing but punishment, suddenly finding only love, only acceptance, only mercy. Now, what is it that enables Victor Hugo, who, as I say, is not a Christian, to write such a compelling character? It is the deeply Christian heritage in France before the Revolution. And the bishop sings, and the musical, I think, is wise to put this in, by the witness of the martyrs, by the passion and the blood, that is, by the death of Jesus, God has raised you out of darkness. I've bought your soul for God. And from that point on, all of the hanging questions that we have in Les Mis, like, does sweet Jesus care? And is there mercy for Fantine's little girl? Start to get answered through this person, Valjean, through this person of the bishop, through ultimately this person of Jesus. What Valjean experiences is an encounter with an intervening God. And this is perhaps a little bit of a stretch, but what I want to say is that is, in essence, the Christian message. John, in his gospel, right at the start, in the prologue, has this verse. He says, no one has ever seen God. That, by the way, is why we have the question we have today. You just can't see him. He doesn't seem real to our experiences. He feels so distant. The reality of who God is seems murky and clouded. No one has ever seen God. That's why, in our extremity, we end up asking, how do we know God is there? But John doesn't finish there. He says, but the one and only Son, who is himself God, and who is at the Father's side, has made him known. What we have needed is an intervention from God. God revealing himself on his own terms. And that is always a surprising thing. Contra Thénardier, it's surprising because when we look at the person of Jesus in history, we can conclude that this God is not dead like the stiffs at our feet. He did something incredibly powerful with very little resources to work with. This peasant from Galilee who has upended history and begun a movement that has been bringing the best change to our world ever since. And not always got it right, I hasten to add. But unlike Thénardier, in Jesus we see strong, strong evidence for the presence of this God. We can't dismiss him. But unlike Javert, this God is nothing like the one we might imagine. He's the God who offers an embrace to wretched people like Jean Valjean, who really ought to deserve nothing but rejection. Now that confronts Javert's expectations, but I think for every one of us here, the person of Jesus, if sincerely studied, will confront our standards and expectations as well. And my experience of having known him for 11 years now has been that I never quite have my finger on everything he's going to do. He's endlessly surprising. He's always better than you think. And we are in a terrible place if we think we have him sorted. This is God revealing himself on his own terms. And so we need to drop our standards and expectations, our filters that we often put on when we think about God, if we're to have an experience of God in Jesus. And that is what Christians have. It means, therefore, that the attitudes that enjoys God's presence is one that comes to God humbly through Jesus. I'm going to say a bit more for the rest of our time together about what kind of relationship this is. But that, I suppose, is my big point. How can we know if God is there? Not just in an abstract way, not just in an intellectual way, not just as philosophers or historians. How can we as human beings, with desires and longings and experiences, know God is there? My thesis, which is not original to me by any means, is through approaching God in Jesus Christ. He is the one in whom and through whom and with whom we can have a close experience with the God who is there. And I have a few things to say about that, but I wonder at this point, does anyone have any questions or any observations you want to make or any points you want to come back on or clarify mean for God to give people up to their sin? Well, in Romans 1, it's their desires that God gives them up to. And this, I think, is one of the things in the Bible. Our desires are a good marker of where we are morally. So that upright people desire God. And one way to define sin is to desire that which is not good and to live that out. So I think it looks like Donald Trump, without making any kind of great political sweeping statements, because it could just as easily have looked like Hillary Clinton. It looks like Donald Trump. Here we are, a culture that glamorizes reality TV, that celebrates people who have achieved pretty much nothing, and obsess over appearance. So what do you get leading the most powerful nation in the world? A man who's all about appearances, for whom truth is not that important, for whom principles mean virtually nothing, who has married the kind of people that we otherwise stick up on our magazines and adore. That's one example of what it looks like. I could multiply examples like that, but I think it means that we go looking for something as unwholesome and hollowing as, I don't know, celebrity culture or a definition of human beings apart from the dignity the Bible says they have. And in the end, that's what we get. And I suppose the fullest definition of that is hell. C.S. Lewis said, I think it's in The Great Divorce, I could be wrong, he says, first they won't, and then they can't, referring to people's relating to God. He says, in the end, there are only two types of people in the world, those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom in the end God says, thy will be done. Do you see what I mean? By no means a light topic to talk about. But actually, this is what makes the gospel so very surprising. I often think when I talk to people who want to know about whether there's a God, there are two things that the Bible instantly challenges them on. First is this. Do they really want there to be a God? And actually, do they have presuppositions that would be keeping him at a distance? But secondly, why would God want to know us? That's hard to say and hear in a self-esteem-laden culture. But why on earth would the God who made everything, who's presumably busy enough keeping the Andromeda galaxy spinning, have any care for something as small and limited and error-prone as you? Why? And yet he does. That's what you find in the Bible. Psalm 8, David says, when I consider the heavens, the moon, and the stars that your fingers have made, what is man that you're mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him. Yet you made him a little lower than the angels, crowned him with glory and honour. That's the story of the gospel. The God who, to be honest, it's a mystery why he should care about us, cares about us more than we can understand. What we deserve is the bishop to come downstairs and say, you stole my silver cutlery, go to prison forever. What we get is him coming downstairs and saying, here, take these candlesticks, go and live in the freedom that I can give you. That's the story of the gospel. That's what we have in Christ. Any other questions at this point?
Yeah,
maybe we're splitting hairs. I think I basically agree with you. I do think that God withholds in response to what we did. So yes, we ran away from him, but I think the Bible does say he in his justice then does something too. So yes, Adam and Eve hide from him, but then God does put them out of the garden and close the gate. But I'm very much agreeing with you that it's our running away from him that is the cause of all these miseries. Yes, and like the story of the prodigal son, that he is willing us on to take one step back to him. Anyway, let me describe, just before I finish, what kind of relationship is possible in Jesus. What kind of knowledge of God is possible? The first thing I want to note is that you can know he's there in your pain. In the incarnation, that is to say, God stepping into human history, God now has not a theoretical, but a personal and physical account of pain with which to work. I have some very close friends whose daughter was born with a cleft palate, and the wife wrote a really moving blog post. They haven't been able to breastfeed their child recently. And she wrote really honestly about how hard it was. And she writes this, "We experienced a real darkness and tiredness. And aside from once catching Matt explaining to our tiny daughter that Jesus was God incarnate and himself had to learn to breastfeed, we almost lost track of where the Lord was altogether." Of course it's been dark for them, so bleak for them. But in the middle of all that darkness, holding their little baby, trying to get her to breastfeed, they were able to hold on to the experience that Jesus once was in that condition. Jesus once had to learn how to feed. What a deep comfort for that family. The person who says, God, why do you feel so far away from me? Why have you forsaken me? They may not get the answer that they're craving, maybe not all their lives, but what they will get is the conviction that God himself knows what it's like to feel that way, and has in fact stepped into a place of sorrow abject enough to say those very words. So that ultimately, no matter how hard things get, how much pain you face, he will still be there, a fellow sufferer. You won't ever be able to outsuffer the man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. You can know he's there in the middle of your pain. And you can know he's there in the middle of your joy. There's a moment in Acts 14 where Paul and Barnabas rock up in Lystra. There are a lot of country bumpkins there. They're all farmers. So Paul doesn't really talk to them about philosophy. He talks to them about farming. And he says to them, they're all trying to sacrifice an offering to him at this point. He says, "Friends, why are you doing this? We too are only human like you. We're bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things, the idols they're about to sacrifice to the living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way. Yet he's not left himself without testimony." And you might be thinking to yourself, what kind of testimony is this going to be? How is God witness to these people in Lystra? Paul continues. He's shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your heart with joy. As much as suffering is a reality in life, so too is joy. And I take it all of us have known moments that were almost out-of-body experiences, the goodness and the pleasure that we were dealing with at that point. Simply couldn't be explained by time, matter, and chance. What do you do in those moments? Dante Gabriel Rossetti was reported once to have said, "The worst moment for an atheist is when he is truly thankful and has no one to thank." But in Jesus, you do know what to do with your joy. You know the one who is the giver of joy, and actually the one to whom that joy is merely a signpost, a drop of water compared to the ocean that is in store at his hands. What kind of relationship do we have in God through Jesus? One where we know him in our pain and in our joy. A few more points. And at this point, I'll be saying a lot of things that might be very familiar. Do interrupt if you like. It's an asymmetrical relationship. Were I to start a friendship with one of you, it would be a process of mutual discovery. You get to know me a bit better, I get to know you a bit better, and on we'd go. But with God, there's a profound asymmetry. I will never stop having things to learn about him. He has never started having to learn things about me. Everything about me is known to him. Very little about him is known to me. So the relationship I have with him is going to be close, is going to be intimate, but it's going to be asymmetrical. It's going to be one in which I am open before him, no secrets from him, and one in which I'm learning more of him all the time. It's going to be asymmetrical. It's going to be based on total acceptance. This is one of the best things about being a Christian. In a relationship you and I might form with each other, we would hold certain things back. We would strategically hide from one another things we think would jeopardize the relationship. I know you don't like a particular band. I will hide all the posters and records I have of that band. Trivial example. But actually, that fear of rejection is what poisons so many of our relationships, isn't it? Is the source of so much of our deep-rooted anxiety and insecurity. A fear that all the elaborate masks we're wearing might slip, people might see us for who we are and never want to talk to us. But a relationship with God in Jesus is one in which you are fully known. That's what Paul celebrates in 1 Corinthians 13. He says, "That day I will know, even as I am fully known." So nothing about you is a surprise to the Lord God. You've nothing to hide from him. It's already known to him. Thirdly, it's one that's being strengthened more and more. God promises to grow you in your relationship with him. One of the main ways he does that is through the Bible. And at Reasonable Faith, and even this morning at another church, I'm often talking about the Bible as a historical source. It is certainly not less than that. But it pleases me for a minute or two now to tell you that it is so much more than that as well. And for the person who comes to Jesus, the Bible is not just a record of his life and deeds, his death and resurrection. It is also his personal voice to us. It is like a wandering sheep hearing the Good Shepherd call us by name. And one of the things you find fascinating is, we've been looking at Daniel, the prophecy of Daniel, with some of the students in the CU recently. One of the things we find fascinating as we've looked at that book is that Daniel is a man who knows how to have visions from the Lord in dreams, all kinds of crazy revelations you wouldn't expect, and yet he's devoted to his Bible. One long chapter, chapter 9, begins because Daniel's been reading the prophecy of Jeremiah, and he realizes that a certain number of years has passed. What point I'm trying to make here is that I wouldn't rule out all kinds of experiences and, I guess, how to put it, circuitous ways of God speaking to us. I wouldn't rule them out. But the thing you have when you look at the Bible is God promising to speak to you anytime you open it. by his Holy Spirit, a living book, that actually the more and more you read it, the more it seems to have known you were coming. Not just in the ways that it seems to land in your conscience, but also in the fact that the writers themselves seem to have a consciousness of things they shouldn't have done. I love the moment where Mary anoints Jesus and everyone attacks her for it, and Jesus says, "She's done a beautiful thing for me. Wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the world, people will know about this." Can you imagine everyone else in the room going, "Huh? Wherever the gospel, the world?" It would seem like a ludicrous comment, except it's not ludicrous. Because here you are, 20 centuries later, reading about it. He knew you were coming, and he wanted you to know. This is a relationship in which we see by faith. And the way our eyes of faith are presented with Jesus is primarily in his words, by his Holy Spirit, shown more and more. Secondarily, this is a community relationship. Another way in which Christ presents himself to us is through other people. I quoted earlier John 1:18, "No one has ever seen God." But, do you know, John says that one more time in his letter, 1 John 4, verse 12. He says, "No one has ever seen God, but if the love of God dwells in us, then he is known and made complete in us." You may know the end of Les Mis is a beautiful moment in which three of the characters, two dead, one about to die, sing, "To love another person is to see the face of God." That is a surprisingly biblical sentiment, however kitschy it might have seemed at first. Actually, the community of Christians, and you'll find one next door in a few minutes, is full of people who can point you to the reality of a God who changes lives, even theirs, and through whom God in his kindness wants to draw near. I also want to add at this point that for people who say, "But I want to touch something, I want to see something," God has not left you without a witness. He gives us, through Jesus, baptism and the Lord's Supper. Two things, one once off and one repeated, quite a great deal, we should hope. Two things in which he promises to meet your desire for something you can see, something you can touch, in fact, something you can eat. And I would say for the Christian, part of knowing and enjoying the presence of God is heightened by the experience of taking that meal together and remembering and enjoying what God promises is in it. It's a relationship, finally, in which we are waiting. And that is where Les Mis ends. Certainly the musical ends with that. It ends with Valjean dying, and that's that. And then the chorus come, and all these figures who died on stage start singing. And they reprise, "Do you hear the people sing?" And they start singing, and it's very beautiful. They start singing, you can read those words, a chorus which is full of Old Testament pictures of hope. "They will walk behind the plowshare and put away the sword. The chain will be broken." You can go to the prophet Isaiah to find someone who is using just that imagery to describe the hope that is on offer. It's the music for people who are climbing to the light. "For the wretched of the earth, there's a flame that never dies." That's the promise of the gospel. That's why it will not pay to be a Thénardier or a Hitler or a Stalin. One day there will be judgment. One day God will assert himself. One day the one who has seemed so distant from us will be near at last. It's worth noting, by the way, this happened on Saturday. Thénardier and Javert are not present in this little number at the end. I think that's a surprisingly profound moment. So I want to finish with, I guess, an invitation to us, particularly anyone here who's thinking about how they can know God more for themselves. I read it recently. It's a little book by Ellis Potter called How Do You Know That? And he spoke at this, didn't he, recently? He's fantastic, Ellis Potter. And he puts it like this. So I'm going to call this, instead of food for thought, soup for thought. He says, "How do we know that we can trust God? We can trust God because he loves us. But how do we know that he loves us? That's complicated. We may be taught that it's true, but there's no formula to demonstrate it. The only way to know God is as a living and personal reality. Entering into that reality can be unsettling because we don't know what to expect. It's as if you're starving and you've been offered a bowl of soup. But at the last moment, before putting the spoon to your lips, you wonder, is this soup healthy or poisoned? That's a reasonable question. And there are various ways of finding out the answer. You can interview the cook and see if he's a homicidal maniac. You can wait for others to eat the soup and watch to see if anyone falls over. If you're very bright, you may decide to chemically analyze the soup, although even a chemical analysis may not give you a clear answer, because the soup may react differently in your metabolism or its properties may change in the cooling process. There are all sorts of variables. but none of them will be sufficient to give you the answer. The only way to really know if the soup is good for you is to eat it. That's living by faith. We eat by faith or we starve to death. Knowledge and reasoning can be helpful and can inform faith, but they'll only take us so far. Faith is necessary. The Bible tells us, taste and see that the Lord is good. Normally, when we taste, we don't see, and when we see, we don't taste. I found that a very stimulating moment, a little bit of soup for thought. If there's anyone here who's thinking, how can I know that God is there? The invitation, founded on all kinds of very secure philosophical moorings, and I think, frankly, undeniable historical evidence, is the person of Jesus, with open arms, longing for you to come in and discover his grace. It's there. It's on offer. Taste and see.